Chapter 30. Superintendent Symington studied Daly as he donned the bulletproof vest and checked his sidearm. When she'd visited Daly's home, she hadn't cared whether he left his job or not. Now that she'd seen him working here in Blan, cut off from just about all aid while dealing with a deadly situation, she had made up her mind that such an asset to her new division, to Police Scotland itself, could not be allowed to simply disappear.
"Tell me again, Jim. I want to know how you intend to approach this, in detail."
"I'm reasonably sure that someone has our missing constable, ma'am. I would bet my life on the fact that Maxwell knows more than he's letting on, and that he's either involved or pressure is being put on him."
"Right. So you and five of the unit are going to where Jock reckons he saw this guy?"
"Yes, ma'am. That's about the height of it. Any word from HQ?"
"Worse than yesterday. If this continues across the country, I'm told that the government are going to call a state of emergency. Across the board, we're working at less than 40% normal operational manpower levels. Worse in the rural divisions. Officers simply can't get to work. We're on our own here."
Daly was about to reply when the phone rang in his pocket.
"Brian, what's happening?"
He listened for a few moments.
"Get a copy of this to me on email."
He ended the call.
"Not more problems, I hope."
"Put it like this, ma'am. Things just got a lot worse than yesterday," said Daly, explaining the nature of Scott's call.
"We really are facing a concerted effort to bring down the family," said Symington. "Brockie murdered, Grant killed and mutilated, Bergner sacrificed and burned on the bonfire. This curse, or whatever you'd call it, is being re-enacted to the letter. Would you agree?"
"Yes, I would," Daly replied, checking his weapon. "The question is, what does the rest of it actually mean?"
"After the fall and all this fire and destruction stuff?"
"Yes."
"It means we're exposed beyond belief, DCI Daly. This is how we'll proceed. I want you to go and check out Jock's lead now, but I can only afford to give you two other officers. I'm taking charge in the mansion, Jim, while you work on the ground, so to speak. I'll need a weapon."
"Yes, of course, ma'am."
"If you can't find our missing colleague up this hill, I'm afraid our priorities will have to change."
"Meaning?"
"It's been made very clear to me that my first duty is to protect the Shannon family."
"Yes, ma'am," said Daly, trying not to let his exasperation show.
"But I'm here on the ground, Jim. I don't care what their surnames are. I intend for us all to survive this."
"And this AGM, ma'am? Shouldn't we make them postpone it?"
"What does it matter? We're all stuck here anyway. It's been intimated to our superiors that if we stand in the way of any Shannon International business, they will take legal action against us and the government. You can only imagine the response."
"The meeting goes ahead."
"Indeed. Now pass me that sidearm, please."
Daly looked on as Symington checked and rechecked the weapon.
"Textbook stuff, ma'am. I see you've handled firearms before."
"I was an inspector in the territorial support group in the Met, Jim. Don't look so surprised. Women can fire a gun just as well as men."
"Oh, yes, of course. I didn't mean..." She smiled.
"You'll find out a lot about me you don't know, DCI Daly. You get going. Leave the Shannon AGM to me. And be careful."
It took Scott three trips to carry the files from Campbell's office to Kinloch Police Station, following which he was tired and hungry. He decided to head to the county hotel in the hope of getting something hot to eat. After negotiating the 200 yards or so of deep snow, he stamped his feet before swinging open the large doors to the hotel.
"Fuck me if it's no Guy Fawkes!"
shouted Annie from behind the bar.
"How did you get back?" asked Scott.
"Before you. I got a lift fae Duncan Henderson in the tractor. I canna say it was the maist pleasurable trip I've ever had, but just as well I came back. The place is going like a fair. I've never seen it this busy on New Year's Day."
The bar was indeed crowded. Scott noticed that people were being served drinks, but no money appeared to be changing hands.
"What's this? Very happy hour or something? A free bar?"
"No, not free. Old Geordie Kennedy has had some kind of windfall. He put 300 behind the bar. Aye. And he says just to gee him a shout when that's done, and he'll put another 300 up. You'll be after a hair of the dog yourself."
No, you're all right. Just a coffee for me. Have you got anything hot on the go? I'm famished.
You're just in the nick of time. We'll run out of diesel for the emergency generator in about an hour, so I'm told. There's no a pint of the stuff to be had in the toon. They've kept what's left for the hospital and yourselves in the emergency services. So get your order in now, or it'll be sandwiches by candlelight.
Just a plate of mince and ties for me, Annie.
Coming up. I hope you're feeling better after last night.
Ach, I just got singed. Nothing to worry about.
No, I mean before that. Do you no remember falling your length on the snow? Your eyes were in the back of your head, man. Fair gibbering you were, eh?
Scott remembered the vision he'd had, lying in the snow at the back of the Black Wherry, and shuddered.
"We'll just keep that to yourselves, Annie," he said,
and made his way to the last empty table, beside a group of old men sitting in the corner of the bar.
"Hey, Hamish, your friend for the police is here," said an elderly drinker,
surprising Scott as he could see no sign of the old fisherman. The table moved, almost spilling a couple of drinks. A hand appeared, then another, clutching at the air. Assisted by his drinking companion, and after no little effort, Hamish was restored to his chair.
"Brian, my old friend. It's no even lunchtime, man. You've had a good new year and no mistake. Ah, it's Geordie here. Just an absolute gentleman, and that's a fact."
This brought a murmur of consensus from the others at the table. One old man was sufficiently moved to rise, unsteadily, to his feet to speak.
"Of all the folk I've known in the toon, Geordie is by far the best." "Morris, are you no the main man right enough?" replied another drinker with a smile. "I'm fair chuffed that you like me so much." "Aye, I'd say that. Lang may your lum reek." "Mind you," said Geordie, taking a sip of his whiskey, "it was only last week you called me the most thrawn old bastard you'd ever met." "But you weren't buying him drink then," declared Hamish. "You've always got too much to say for yourself, Hamish," said Morris, still on his feet. "The way you patter on, you'd think whiskey was as big a stranger to you as bathwater."
Hamish leaned across the table, knocking over two glasses of whiskey, and grabbed Morris's jacket.
"Don't you think you're safe standing up there, you bugger? I'll just fair loup o'er this table and gi' you the thrashing of your life." "So you will. If I was as old as you, I'd be back in the house with a blanket over my knees, nursing a mug of cocoa. But if you want to die with a drink in your hand, well, you're going the right way about it." "No, boys," said Geordie, "not only is this a new year, I'm going to celebrate my good fortune. Now I'm out of the clutches of that daughter of mine." "Just you sit back doon, Rocky," said Scott, pulling Hamish back into his seat. "What was your good fortune, if you don't mind me asking, Geordie?" "Ach, happened just after Christmas. I was sitting in the house, fair lamenting the fact that my daughter and her weans weren't going back up to Glasgow until after Hogmanay, when I got a knock at the door. To cut a long story short, it was two fellas said they were collecting old photos of the area, and did I have any?" "And you did, I take it?" "Loads! Just loads! My dear mother was a right one for photographs. I've got that many of hers, I don't know what to do with them. These blokes went through them all, aye, every one." "You'd be glad to get rid of them, I'm quite sure," replied Scott. "That's the strange thing. They were only interested in five photos, but bugger me, they weren't short and paired for them right enough. They gied me $3,000.
He hesitated, as though he'd said something wrong.
"But you good folk will no be interested in all that. $3,000 for five old photos. What were they of? Bonnie Prince Charlie? Lord Lucan? No, just my mother when she worked at Kersevay House in Blan." "You never telled me that," said Hamish, rising from the table again, his fists bunched into tight balls.
So you got into 3 grand, and just thought you'd make your way into my house when you knew fine I had similar pictures since our mothers worked together. Well, if you got any more dosh for them, I'm wanting my share right now, you thieving swine.
He took a swing at his drinking companion, then tipped backwards and was caught by Scott, who guided him safely back into his chair.
"Enough's a feast for you, my boy," said Scott, beckoning for Annie to come over. "These two men that bought the photos off you, Geordie, what did they look like?"
The detective's heart sank as the old man described the butcher journalists, Grant and Brockie. The path up the glen was steep and deep with snow. Daly and two of the support units struggled along in the general direction Jock had described. The silence was punctuated only by the distant lap of the sea on the shore far below, and the police officer's heavy footfall and occasional oaths when the snow was deeper than expected. Daly was carrying a sidearm, while his colleagues both carried semi-automatic weapons slung over their shoulders. Symington had made it clear that they couldn't risk being unprepared. Daly felt enormous, with a bulletproof vest on under his ski jacket.
"Sir," whispered the cop immediately behind him as they neared a copse of trees. "Can you smell that? I'm sure it's cigarette smoke."
Daly sniffed the air. Sure enough, the pungent smell of tobacco was obvious. He peered into the trees and saw a thin thread of blue smoke spiral into the air. All three police officers sank to their knees. Daly turned to them.
"I want us going in from different angles. Side each for you. I'll take the straight route."
He could feel his heart thumping in his chest as he released the safety catch on his handgun and moved forwards towards the smoke. As directed, the other officers disappeared into the trees on either side of him. According to Jock, there was a clearing just after the first line of trees and, sure enough, as Daly slid his way forwards, he could see the woods opening out in front of him. Almost bent double, he crouched behind the large trunk of a fir tree, peering ahead through the pine needles. The sudden fall of snow from the branch of a tree made him jump. He glanced back, but there was nothing behind him. He looked left and right for any sign of his colleagues, but they were obviously staying well out of sight, awaiting his command. Something caught his eye. Another puff of blue smoke drifted through the trees. Daly eased himself up and squinted further into the clearing. He caught his breath when he made out a figure sitting on a log, their back to the detective, a cigarette dangling from their outstretched fingertips. Again, Daly looked left and right. No sign of the support unit officers. He reached for the handset in his pocket. They were all wearing earpieces, so voice contact, as long as he was quiet, was possible. "Alpha 1 calling Sierra Uniform 1 and 2. Make your way slowly into the clearing using due caution. Suspect spotted straight ahead of me. Over." He listened for the blip response, indicating the men had heard his message. But there was silence. "Sierra Uniform 1 and 2, please respond. Over." Again, Daly's pleas went unanswered. He sighed. Should he try to move forwards and attempt to engage the smoking figure? He reckoned he had no alternative. Daly left the relative security of the tree trunk and half ran, half waded through the thick snow. He was only feet away from the figure on the log when he stopped.
"I am an armed police officer. Please stand slowly with your hands in the air."
The figure didn't move. Daly took 2 steps closer. On the edge of his hearing, he could make something out. In the beginning, it was barely perceptible. Soon it became a whine. The wind was getting up, and the branches of the trees began to wave in the breeze, divesting themselves of their heavy white burden. All around him, snow began to fall in heavy clumps, thudding dully as it landed. A bird flapped into the air, and Daly jumped. He could see the figure properly now. Puffs of blue smoke still rose into the cold air.
"One last time, turn around."
Slowly, the figure, draped in a black cloak, stood, and turned to face Daly. His gasp of recognition was stopped in his throat as he felt a crushing pain on the back of his head. He struggled for a few heartbeats, trying to remain conscious as the familiar face swam in front of him. Then another blow hit him hard on the head, as the whine through the trees grew louder. Chapter 31
People began to take their seats around the long boardroom table in the ballroom of Kersevay House. Ailsa sat at one end, her son Bruce to her right, her granddaughter Nadia, accompanied by Mrs. Watkins, to her left. At the other end of the table sat Maxwell. To his right, where normally Lars Bergner would have been seated, the grey figure of COO Linton sat, meticulously polishing his glasses with a grey cloth. Across from him was Brady, staring at an iPad and seemingly entirely at ease. Bruce looked on as various members of the extended family took their seats. They were, in the main, minority shareholders, but their stake in the family business had made them rich, and in most cases spoiled and disinterested. They were there to nod and vote and do what they were told by either of the power bases that protected their interests. They attended the AGM only because, as per the company constitution, they stood to lose their shares if absent. He studied his mother. She was composed, with a benign look on her face, as hard to read as ever. As the board of Shannon International settled into their seats, a stream of accountants, lawyers, advisers, and mere bag carriers entered the room, mainly taking positions behind the central players. His mother's accountant and corporate lawyer sat behind her, not part of the meeting, but able to whisper in her ear as it progressed. At the other end of the table, Maxwell's people arrived, clustering around him, much greater in number than his mother's advisers. Bruce watched as they jostled for position, behind his cousin, who was already wearing his self-satisfied grin. A dark-haired girl sat down near Brady. She was pretty, with deep brown eyes. Something about her was familiar, but he couldn't work out what it was. He had to avert his gaze when she caught his eye and smiled. It was then that it dawned on him. She was the girl with the nice backside he'd seen in the bar in Notting Hill only 2 days earlier. She was the woman he'd seen leaving the bar with Trenton Casely. This could be no coincidence. Suddenly the reality of how deeply he was involved, exposed even, hit home. Scott stared at his computer screen. Though it was New Year's Day, he had decided to call the local librarian at home, in the hope that she might be able to throw some light on the history of Kersevay House, and why old images of the place were suddenly in such demand. The thought had churned over in his mind as he waited for her to answer the phone. Why would someone go to all the trouble of paying journalists to look for old photographs of the building and those who occupied it so long ago? Moreover, why then would those same journalists end up dead? As it turned out, the librarian had been very helpful. She told Scott that Grant and Brocky had visited her at the library a few days before Christmas, asking about Kersevay House and whether she knew anything of its history or had any old photographs. Funny, she had said, we used to have a display on the Shannons and their affiliation with the area on display in the old library when I started working there. Apparently they complained, so the whole thing was stuck in the attic. When I spoke to the journalists, I told them that it must have been disposed of at some point. I certainly didn't see hide nor hair of it when we moved to our new building. And? Well, they asked if I had any images on file or the computer, and I said no. They seemed to lose all interest after that. It was only a couple of days later, when I was going through boxes still unopened after our move, that I found it. What, the display? Yes, dusty and a bit sorry-looking, but intact. I took pictures of it all and filed them digitally. I had intended to pass it on to the journalists after the holidays. I called the number they left, but never got a reply. Scott was staring at those images now. The old house on the hill in sepia print. People in old clothes, from around the 30s, Scott thought. Some smart and prosperous, others dressed in the threads of service. For the time, Scott reckoned, the photography was good, obviously the work of a professional, though everything seemed very stiff and posed. As he went through the images and text about how the house came into being and what wonderful, benevolent and successful people the Shannons were, he stopped at one image. A little boy had been caught on the edge of a group of people, all standing stiffly and looking solemnly into the lens. The young lad must have thought himself out of shot, for unlike the others, he was looking to the side, a little away from the main party. It was the expression on the boy's face that caught his eye. A waspish, disgruntled glare, so at odds with his age.
"Old before your time," Scott mused aloud.
There was something really familiar about that face, he thought, and the expression on it. He took his phone from his pocket and snapped a picture. He flicked through more photographs to see if he could see the young boy again. As he clicked open another folder of images, he stopped. His throat began to constrict, and he could feel the sweat on his brow. There, wearing a little camel coat with a velvet collar, was another little boy. Scott didn't have to wonder about the familiarity of that face. He'd seen it before. It was young Archie Shannon, the photo obviously taken not long before his disappearance. Scott gripped the desk in front of him, his fingers going white at their tips, desperately trying to force away the blackness at the corner of his eyes and remain conscious. He took deep breaths, telling himself he was safely ensconced in Kinloch Police Office. But the ringing in his ears began.
"Fuck this! No! No!" he shouted, slamming his fist down into the desk. "I'm not giving into this!"
"I would like to bring the annual general meeting to order," shouted Maxwell, banging a wooden gavel.
The general buzz died down to a whisper, as the acting chairman of Shannon International cleared his throat and consulted the notes in front of him.
"As you know, it is with a heavy heart that I chair today's proceedings. I would much rather my father, our chairman, were here. As we all know, his condition remains the same, though every effort is being made to care for him."
Bruce could only smile at the murmur of agreement that echoed around the table. Of one thing he was sure. If he could get away with it, Maxwell would happily strangle his own father in order to have the full reins of power. The hypocrisy was staggering. Still, this was the little world in which they found themselves, and in Bruce's experience, hypocrisy was always the order of the day.
"As you are also aware, beside me now should be our CEO, Lars Bergner. I don't need to tell you about his disappearance, nor the events surrounding it. Our thoughts are with his wife and children, as we earnestly hope for his safe return. I am aware that some of you believe that this meeting should not proceed under these circumstances. However, I think you're wrong. Lars is a professional to his fingertips," said Maxwell, raising a few eyebrows at his use of the present tense. Not to mention any talk of fingers. "He would want us to carry on in a professional manner. We have a global business to run, which is bigger than any one of us."
There was a murmur of general agreement.
"Besides," he continued, "we're stuck here in Blaan. What else have we got to do?"
Despite the circumstances, many members of the board of Shannon International began to laugh.
"All agreed?"
Maxwell looked around the table for detractors.
"Good. Let us proceed."
Scott had bettered the vision, fought it away. He was now drinking a cup of strong coffee, his hands shaking, trying to compose himself.
"It's good news," he thought. "Maybe I'm getting the better of this. Maybe the booze is losing."
Then he remembered the amount of whiskey he'd consumed on Hogmanay. He sighed and looked at the wall, then decided to look for more images of the little boy with the scowl, who was so strangely familiar. There were no more pictures of him in the library files, so he decided to delve into the old casket of papers Campbell had given him. He turned over press-cutting after press-cutting, referring to the Cursive House case. Torquil Drysdale, in one way or another, appeared to have been obsessed by it all. He had archived just about every snippet of information there was available. Under the piles of newspapers, Scott found more old photographs. One image showed some low cottages and outbuildings. Judging by the surrounding landscape, it was the site on which Cursive House now stood. He found a tattered sepia photograph that had been torn in two and glued back together. It showed a broad, thick-set man in a leather apron, standing beside a sturdy plough horse. He had a shock of dark, wiry hair, and eyed the camera with a steady gaze. When Scott turned the photograph over, he found the name Nathaniel Stewart scribbled across the back in faded ink. He ploughed on, until he came to another picture of Stewart. Older now, his face was lined, with streaks of white through his hair. He looked broad and strong,
standing beside two young children on a pier in front of a steamship. As Scott peered at the photograph, he realized that the boy in the image was the same young lad he'd seen scowling at the stiff, posed subjects of the old picture taken at Cursivay House. What was it about that child that was so familiar? The scrawled writing, this time bolder and less faded, read, "Nathaniel Stewart leaves Kinloch." There was no mention of the children, who looked too young to be Stewart's offspring. Beside the boy, a little girl clutched a rag doll to her chest. Brady spoke up in his loud New York drawl.
"I have the figures for the last year of trading by our global holding company. If you open the folder in front of you, you'll be able to follow what's going on quite easily. You can see that our turnover is down by 1.3% since this meeting last year. This may seem insignificant until you factor in the numbers we're talking about," he said, as assorted board members nodded in solemn approval. "As a business, we aren't out of trouble yet, though I'm pleased to say that Shannon International has weathered the recent financial storm better than most."
"I see this is correct only until Monday last, Charles," said Ilza.
"Yes, that's true, but we always have the same cut-off date prior to our AGMs here. You must understand that, such is the complex nature of these accounts, we have to have statements fully prepared and checked well in advance."
"May I ask about trading in the last 10 days, particularly in the days after Christmas?"
Brady looked across the table towards Maxwell, who took the hint and interrupted the little exchange.
"Of course we can get you those figures, Aunt Ailsa, but not today. I'll send them to you as soon as they're prepared."
"Oh, good. I'm sure it'll make for most interesting reading."
Bruce looked between his mother, Brady, and Maxwell with interest. Brady did his job, and did it well. He was part of Shannon International's leadership, but not of it. Most importantly, he had always been Ailsa's man. But now Bruce sensed a change. The dark-haired girl leaned into Maxwell, listened to what he had to say, then quietly left the meeting. Bruce watched her go, admiring her as she went.
"Now, ladies and gents, if you could take a look, we'll go through what's been making us all rich this year," said Brady,
as a large screen slid silently from the ceiling, almost filling the entire wall at the far end of the ballroom. Bruce was convinced that he saw a nervous look pass between Brady and Maxwell. When he looked to see if his mother had picked up on this, he noted that she looked as serene and untroubled as ever. There was no doubt about it. The next few hours were going to be amongst the most testing of his life. But he was ready. Suddenly, Bruce wished that the glass in front of him was full of whiskey instead of mineral water. Scott busied himself reading the rest of the history of the Shannon family that had come from the library. Much was made of their long connection to Blan and the philanthropic work they had been responsible for over the years. He wasn't surprised to note that the police office in which he was currently ensconced, as well as the sheriff court down the road, had both been built by previous Shannons and gifted to the town. It was only when he read about Blan itself that he encountered the history of the Rat Stone, or Stain, as it was termed in the old document. He squinted through his glasses and read. "The Rat Stain occupies an oaken copse nestling in a valley known locally as the Vale of the Druids. Its origins appear to be ancient, possibly prehistoric, dating back to the hunter-gatherer period. One of many theories about the stone is that it was a meeting place or site of governance, as in the Teutonic Rat House. But this is not universally agreed upon. In James VI's treatise on witches and the supernatural, the monument is mentioned in connection with the Druidic tradition. Indeed, the literal translation of its location is Valley of the Magicians, as many considered this ancient order to be. Time has obscured their true nature, but stories of human sacrifice abound in local myth and legend, and the construction of the stone itself would appear to lend credence to this hypothesis. It is probably also the case that they saw themselves as guardians of tradition and of their surroundings. There is little doubt that they acted positively to protect and nurture their landscape, keeping the balance between ancient people and their impact on their environment. Of current inhabitants of Blan, none are more intimately connected with its ancient past than the Sinclair Stuarts. Local legend tells us that they dominated the area from their base at the top of Cursive Cliff, fending off all comers, including, it is said, the Romans. It was only the arrival of the Scotti, or Scots, from across the North Channel that brought about the end of their power in the region. The Druids were routed, forced to the margins of society, until their extinction at the hands of the families who settled in the village thereafter. Most notable of these families were the Shannons, who now have significant landholdings in and around Blan, stretching as far as Kinloch. Legend has it that they learned how to work metal from the Sinclair Stuarts and were skilled blacksmiths. The worshippers of Blan still talk of going to the Stane when they attend the kirk in the village. Here again, the Shannon family appear to have usurped the Sinclair Stuarts as hereditary ministers of the parish. From the infamous bloody minister to the present day, it is a Reverend Shannon who calls the faithful to prayer in Blan. Scott read the passage over again. So not only had Nathaniel Stuart lost the family's ancient home to the Shannon family, but over hundreds of years, the incomers had taken almost everything from them. The little boy in the coat with the velvet collar sprung to mind. This time, though, Scott was untroubled by the mental picture. He rifled through the papers that Campbell had given him. There he was again. For the first time, D.S. Scott saw something unutterably sad in young Archie Shannon's expression. Sad and, like the boy with the scowl, oddly familiar. Chapter 32 Daly was kneeling on what felt like pebbles. He had just regained consciousness and was desperately trying to orientate himself. He was cold, shivering uncontrollably. His hands were tied behind his back, and he realized, as he tried to move, that he was tethered to something. Through his stinging nostrils, the smell of the sea was strong.
"Let me out of here!" he shouted,
his voice weak with cold, but still echoing around the dark space.
"I'm a police officer!"
he called again, in no real hope that his pleas would make any difference. He was surprised when he heard a groan in response. Somewhere behind him there was a faint voice.
"Sir, it's me, Sandy Whitlock, P.C. Whitlock,"
the man's voice was strained.
I came with you to—"
He let out a blood-curdling scream and fell silent. Daly could hear footsteps crunching behind him. He felt his spine tingle, waiting for the blow, the kick, the sharp knife in his back. He remembered the horrific sight of Colin Grant, eviscerated, his lungs thrust over his shoulders in bloody agony as his life drained away.
"Who are you?"
he asked, as calmly as he could. There was no reply, though the footsteps had stopped. His captor was now studying him as he kneeled forwards, trussed up on the pebble floor. Daly tried desperately to think through the fog in his brain. His head was pounding, no doubt caused by the blows that had rendered him unconscious. A seagull's distant cry sounded a pitiful lament, for lost souls, or for those about to be lost. Daly thought of his young son, so new to this world. He felt tears welling up in his eyes. His throat ached. He clenched his teeth to banish them. He had to remain strong, if not for himself, then for his fellow captives.
"I am a police officer," he repeated. "If you harm me or any of my colleagues, you will be caught, and you'll never be free again for the rest of your life. Whatever it is you're trying to achieve, whatever twisted purpose you have in mind, it has to end here."
Silence. He was shivering so badly he could barely make the words form in his mouth.
"I want you to think about what you're doing. Think very hard."
The person crunched closer to him, stopping at his back. Daly looked at the ground before him in the gloom. A dim light shone from somewhere up ahead.
"I know where we are. We've been investigating the death of Colin Grant. Your sea cave is no secret."
He stopped suddenly, involuntarily, sharply drawing the cold air into his lungs. A soft hand ran slowly down the length of his back,
DCI Jim Daly closed his eyes and waited for the agony to begin.
"Jock Monroe, it's me, Sergeant Brian Scott. I hope I'm not disturbing you," he said, looking at the old photograph of Nathaniel Stewart on the pier at Kinloch with the two young children.
"And how's the head this morning?" boomed Jock, his voice just as loud and resonant over the phone. "I've seen police officers at some capers in my time, but never jumping through the flames of a bonfire. You're obviously a one-off, Brian."
"You're not the first person to mention that, my friend," Scott raised his eyebrows. "I'm glad the phones are still working."
"The phones will be the last thing to go here. As I said to you last night, we in Blan have the Shannons to thank for such connectivity. They tell me that we even have broadband here. Not that I have use for such a thing."
"I need to pick your brains about something," said Scott. "Do you know anything about what happened to Nathaniel Stewart when he left the area?"
"Bits and pieces, Brian. The old man had faced humiliation, as I mentioned to you. He had relations over in Ireland. Donegal, I think I'm right in saying. He left Blan sometime in the '30s. I'm not sure of the exact date."
"I have a photograph here of him with two young children. It was taken the day he left Kinloch, or so it says on the back. Do you know who they are?"
"That will be his grandchildren, Brian. His daughter's children. She was married, then suffered some kind of breakdown. Some people said she was wrong in the head, but you know how it goes in small communities. Anyhow, he was like a father to the children, so it is said."
"So none of them ever came back?"
"Well, if you listen to the fishwives in the village, you might believe that Nathaniel Stewart did pay one visit back to Blan. It was a black day in the village when young Archie Shannon went missing."
"Archie Shannon? Where did that come from?"
said Scott, slightly discomforted by mention of the little boy who kept appearing in his head.
"There are many in the village that would swear they saw Nathaniel Stewart around that time, back here in Blan."
"What, you mean he took the wain?"
"So the gossips would have it, Brian."
"But he must have been an old man."
"He didn't die until the '70s, in a hospital in Dublin. Somehow the Kinloch Herald got a hold of the story, a minor miracle in itself, I assure you. He was in his 90s.
"And what do you think, Jock?"
"Though old Nathaniel was forced into hard times, he had no shortage of allies. He was the keeper of great secrets again, if you believe the tittle-tattle. True or not, he commanded a lot of respect in certain quarters, aye, and not just in Kinloch."
"What secrets? I thought he was damn near destitute."
"There are many greater things than money, Sergeant Scott. Nathaniel Stewart is credited by many as being the last holder of a great office."
"Not you too, Jock. Mere mumbo-jumbo."
Scott was slightly put out when he heard Jock's laugh bellow through the earpiece.
"Many will tell you that Nathaniel Stewart was the last druid. Google that. I think that is the correct expression. And see how you get on, Brian. Now, if you'll forgive me, I must get out for my constitutional before the snow comes on again."
Scott said goodbye and ended the call, staring into the commanding eyes of Nathaniel Stewart in the old photograph. In Blan, Jock Monroe looked out of his window and sighed, still holding the telephone. He put it back onto the table and walked across to the bureau, upon which sat his old typewriter. He opened a slim drawer and fumbled under some sheets of paper, removing a small photograph. He sighed deeply as he looked at the tall, broad-shouldered man and the two children standing in front of the steamship on the pier at Kinloch. Superintendent Symington awoke with a start. It was the same dream she always had, the kind that didn't end with sleep. The boy was in slow motion, a look of horror on his face as he was propelled towards the windscreen. She'd been dozing, sitting in her room at Kersabay House with D.C. Dunn and Inspector Aitchison from the support unit.
"Are you okay, ma'am?"
asked Dunn.
"Fine. Just a bad dream."
Symington took a deep breath and tried yet again to banish that face. She'd hoped moving to a new job might make a difference. There had been no contact with Daly and his party for over 2 hours, and the superintendent was beginning to worry.
"Definitely no way we can get anyone from Kinloch at the moment, ma'am. And you are aware of the situation as regards division,"
said Dunn.
"The road between here and Kinloch is blocked, though my information is that they will be able to make it through with snow ploughs in the next hour or so, so long as we don't get another heavy snowfall."
"What do the weather people say?" asked Symington.
"I talked to the Met Office at Prestwick, ma'am. They're finding it hard to give an exact forecast."
"Oh, very helpful.
One thing they're pretty certain of is there will be more snow."
Symington looked at the bank of the screens in front of her, showing various parts of Kersabay House on CCTV.
"We have 4 missing officers and one of the richest families in the world to protect. Bloody brilliant." "We could try and get some cops from Kinloch by boat, ma'am," suggested Dunn. "If we hear nothing from Daly in the next hour, we might have to consider that."
Symington walked to the window and looked out over the bay.
"How far is the place Colin Grant was found from here, D.C. Dunn?"
3 or 4 miles across the hills, ma'am. The way things are underfoot, I don't think a tractor or a 4x4 would make it. Has to be done by air or sea."
Dunn stopped suddenly.
"Ma'am, you don't think—" "I have to think about everything, Mary. But if it's hard for us to move about, then it's equally hard for everyone else."
"Once they're at sea, ma'am, there's no problems," remarked Aitchison, unfolding a map of South Kintyre. "Look at this. Little coves, inlets, secluded bays. If you have local knowledge, you could easily hide away."
"Do your rounds, Inspector. We may need to consolidate things in the house if Daly doesn't turn up soon."
"Yes, ma'am."
Symington looked at her young colleague. D.C. Dunn was wringing her hands, staring out at the heavy sky above the grey sea.
"I know how you feel, Mary," she said.
"Sorry, ma'am." "You don't need to say anything. I'm not being judgmental. These things happen."
"How did you find out?"
"I'm a detective, Mary. Underneath all this braid, I mean. It wasn't hard. The way you and DCI Daly look at each other is proof enough."
"Sorry, ma'am. I don't know what to say. We've tried so hard to make sure it doesn't affect our work."
"Take my advice, Mary. Not as your boss, as someone who knows the score. Don't have regrets. Don't let what seems right make any decisions for you. Regardless of what anyone says, it's your life."
"Thank you, ma'am."
"Not the kind of advice I should be giving out as your superior officer. I should be threatening you with hell and damnation, instant dismissal. But I know that won't work. When I'm old and buggered with no one to talk to, do you think Police Scotland will send somebody round to keep me company?"
"Do you think he'll be okay?"
"Of course he will," replied Symington, with much more confidence than she felt.
The Shannon International AGM at Kersabay House was becoming unruly. A number of the smaller investors were arguing about a proposal to dilute the shareholding of the company in order to bring other non-family members onto the board. Maxwell was doing his best to quell their doubts, but decided to lay the issue aside in favour of the most pressing item on his agenda.
"We have to accept the fact that, as a company, we have a shortage of board-level experience in certain sectors, notably nanotechnology and robotics. These are areas we cannot hope to avoid given the structure of the organisation. We need strong, independent leadership, not the hobbled executive we have now, which has to defer to the board whenever a decision is made."
"You mean we should let you do what you want?" said Bruce.
"Who else?"
Ailsa had been uncharacteristically silent during the course of proceedings. In fact, she had seemed distracted, spending much of her time poring over an electronic tablet with one of her advisers.
"I would like your input before we put this motion to the vote, Aunt Ailsa," said Maxwell impatiently.
"It's the same as last year's motion, and the previous 3 years, if I'm not much mistaken. That I be invested with full executive authority over global operations, in line with my position as executive chairman. Yes, it is." "Acting executive chairman, darling," said Ailsa with a smile. "I propose we vote."
"Seconded," said Linton at his side. All those in favour of awarding full executive powers to our current acting chairman, Maxwell Shannon, please raise your hands,
Linton said, looking down both sides of the long boardroom table. It was at this point the Shannon AGM normally split along partisan lines. Sure enough, those normally in Ailsa's camp remained resolutely unmoving.
"Motion failed," said Linton, making sure he had counted twice before making the decision. "Two votes short of a majority."
"Hang on." Brady turned to face Ailsa. "I'm sorry, Mrs. Shannon, we can't go on the way we are. We need leadership, and Maxwell's the only leader on offer right now."
He raised his hand to vote for the motion.
"You're still one vote short."
Nadia leaned forwards and looked at Maxwell. "You can't do anything unless you have a majority," she said with a nervous, if somewhat triumphant, smile.
"Ah, dear Nadia," said Maxwell, "but we aren't finished, are we?"
He looked down towards Ailsa's end of the table. Slowly, Bruce Shannon raised his hand.
Chapter 33 Daly was reeling. He'd taken another hefty blow to the head, which had spiralled him into unconsciousness. This time, as he came round, he found his thoughts and memories even more difficult to grasp. The only thing that seemed to matter to him was the biting cold, and he found himself struggling to breathe. He had to use his experience, remember the lessons that so many years in the job had taught him. "As soon as you lose your head, son, you've lost a lot." The words of his first sergeant were like a salve. He had repeated them to himself many times over the years, but they were more important now than ever before. He had to fight the darkness in whichever form it presented itself.
"You're back with us, Mr. Daly." The voice was slow and quiet. "It's hard seeing a strong man brought down like this, but you're not the first and you won't be the last. Men like you have been falling for hundreds, thousands of years."
Daly was still struggling to control his breathing, to make sense of his circumstances, but something was telling him that to recognize this voice was important, that it could save him.
"You... you shouldn't do this, you don't have to,"
he said, trying anything to strike up some kind of dialogue with his tormentor.
"Ah, but I do. I must admit, I didn't expect you to fly into my little trap. I'm pleased to see you, though, really pleased. The stronger the heart, the greater the sacrifice."
"What?"
"It's like giving, Mr. Daly. The more you give, the greater will be your return in the afterlife. Is that not what you Christians believe?"
"Us Christians? What are you on about?"
Inside his throbbing head, something told him he knew this person. He recognized those smooth tones, but he was so cold and broken, so confused.
"Tonight, we take you to the stone."
The voice was near him, almost whispering into his ear.
"You will give us immortality as we send you to the void."
Bruce didn't look at his mother or daughter as he rushed from the ballroom and down the long sweep of the stairwell. He had to get out and into the fresh air. He felt as though the ballroom was about to swallow him whole. He could feel the anger and hatred in the atmosphere. He had let them down, but how could they know the real reason for his actions? He needed a smoke. He needed a drink. Finally, he was at the huge front door. It hadn't changed since he was a child. He'd been warned never to open it, never to go out alone. Thoughts of his older brother, never far away. His mother, father, Percy, every adult he could remember, warned of the danger of turning the big brass handle that he had to stand on tiptoes to reach. Even doing this now sent a pang of fear through his heart, the memory still strong. Through this door,
his older brother had left Cursive A House, never to return. As he looked down at the handle, he felt as though he'd done the same thing, left his family, left his life. Banishing these thoughts, he pulled it open and walked outside, fumbling for his cigarettes.
"I want you to get here as soon as you can, D.C. Scott. What's the latest with the road?"
asked Superintendent Symington.
"They're having bothered getting up the brae. Try to get some snowblower up to move the stuff. It could be hours yet. Apparently it's drifted to over 20 feet in some places, ma'am," replied Scott, playing with an unlit cigarette he was desperate to smoke.
"Well, we have no air support. Everything is snowbound in Glasgow. There's only one alternative."
"It's okay, ma'am. Every time I'm here, it's only a matter of time until I'm on a boat. I'll see if I can get a hold of Newell. It might be a terrifying experience, but it's fast, and we need to find Jimmy. I mean, DCI Daily, ma'am."
"I'm worried, Brian,"
she said, surprising Scott with her familiarity.
"We've had no contact with him or his party. I can't afford to lose anyone else from here. We're already well below the number of men the Chief Constable demanded we use to protect the Shannons. If I go looking for Daly in this snow, leaving a skeleton presence here at the house, I could be placing everyone at risk. Get here as quickly as you can, by any means possible, with as many men as they can spare in Kinloch, and make sure anyone who's permitted to carry a firearm does so."
"Could they not just be stuck in the snow? DCI Daly, I mean, ma'am."
"Anything is possible. But after what's happened here over the last few days, we can't take any chances. I'm not willing to risk the lives of my officers. Even if they are just lost in the snow, how long do you think they'll last? Do you expect them to build a bloody igloo or something? We have to search."
"Yes, ma'am," said Scott, putting down the phone. "Guns and boots," he thought. "That's how I'll remember this place. Guns and boots." He looked at his desk. The photograph of Nathaniel Stewart and the two young children sat amidst old paper clippings, sepia images, and other detritus from the old casket of papers from the solicitors. He stared at the young boy's face, but, try as he might, he couldn't make the connection. He picked up the photograph and thrust it into the inside pocket of his jacket. Beneath lay an old newspaper from the '60s. Another young face stared up at him, from a photograph taken decades later. This time Scott was ready. He grabbed onto the desk and closed his eyes.
"This is no going to happen again," he said, as he heard the familiar whine in his ears and felt his chest contract.
He held his breath, then let it out slowly.
"Right, Jimmy, I'm on my way. Don't know how, but I'm coming, mate."
Bruce was fumbling in his pockets for his lighter when he heard the large front door creak open again.
"Well done, mate," said Moore. "You did what you had to do."
"I'm not proud of it. I wish to fuck I'd never become involved with this nonsense. I can't believe I've helped give my cousin control of the company."
"Listen, Bruce, you know the score. Stick to the plan, and your cousin won't be smiling soon. Trust me."
As he flicked at his lighter, Bruce spotted something at the bottom of the steps, almost obscured by the snow. He stepped down to examine what turned out to be a box covered with a thick layer of black duct tape. He picked it up and shook it, then turned it over. "Ailsa Shannon, care of Cursive A House," read a note covered in polythene and taped to the underside of the box.
"What's that?" asked Moore.
"Don't know. It's addressed to my mother,"
said Bruce, still examining the parcel.
"Bloody hell! The way things are going here, it could be anything from a light Christmas present to a parcel bomb. I'd give it to your security boys to open if I were you."
"Good thinking," said Bruce. "Then they can give it to her. I'm certainly the last person she wants to see bearing gifts right now."
Scott had managed to round up three other officers from the town. It left Kinloch woefully undermanned, but these were exceptional circumstances. They collected weapons and body armour and drove through the snow down Kinloch's main street to the pier, where Newell's Rib was normally berthed. Scott had tried to phone the retired sea captain, but got no reply. He cursed when he saw Newell's place at the pontoons empty. Scott looked around. The pier, deep in snow, appeared deserted. He called Campbell's home number, deciding that he would have to ask the local lifeboat, of which Campbell was coxswain, to take him to Blan. After all, the life of his colleague could very well be at stake.
"Dear Scott here from Kinloch Police," he said, when a woman picked up the phone.
Is Mr. Campbell there?
Hello, Sergeant. No, I'm afraid my husband is off on a mercy mission. The hospital were running out of certain vital medicines, and he's taken the lifeboat across to Ayr to get them. They left about an hour ago.
Sure enough, when Scott looked across to the far pier, he saw that the large orange and blue lifeboat was nowhere to be seen.
Fuck, he's away right enough. I mean, oh, you're quite right, Mrs. Campbell, he said, wincing at his oath.
He looked around. A few fishing boats were moored at the quayside, their tackle, rigging and superstructure covered in thick snow. There was not a soul to be seen.
Sir, do you hear that?
Asked McKinven, a young constable standing stiffly in a flak jacket. Scott cocked his head to the side. Sure enough, there was singing, and what sounded like a harmonica coming from further up the pier. He ended the call to Mrs. Campbell.
Come on, lads.
They walked along the snowy quayside until Scott stopped and looked over the edge of the pier, where the singing was loudest. The vessel was a fishing boat, but small and old-fashioned, made of wood, unlike the larger, more sturdy modern craft. "I wish I was in Carrickfergus," sang a rough chorus made up of three or four voices.
"You down there,"
shouted Scott to the singers, who were out of sight somewhere aboard the small boat.
"It's the police. I need to talk to whoever's in charge."
"You better get yourself out there,"
said a slurred voice that Scott recognised. Eventually, after much coughing, swearing and stumbling, a man in an old flat cap poked his head out of the wheelhouse.
"Can I help yez?"
the fisherman slurred.
"Aye, you can. I'm commandeering this boat in the name of... in the name of Her Majesty," said Scott, rather unsure under what authority he was about to take the vessel.
"No, you'll find that the law of the sea and the law of the land are two very different things. For instance, I can stand at the head of this pier and consume as much whisky as I can throw down my throat in broad daylight. The minute I step onto the road, you boys have the right to huckle me away up the brae to the cells."
"And your point is?"
"Just an illustration of how you've nae power to order me to gie you the time of day, never mind command of my boat."
The old fisherman crossed his arms, happy with his response.
"What about being drunk in charge of a fishing vessel?"
asked Scott, now even more unsure of himself.
"No such charge. The Royal Navy could maybe get me on that, but no a landlubber like yourself. And if I was you, I'd get up to the Douglas Arms. When I was in there a wee while ago, just for one, you understand, there was a wild carry-on. Aye, fair brewing it was. Peter McIntosh had just called Tommy Witherspoon a cheat at golf, so you can just imagine what was about to kick off. Do yourself a favour and nip it in the bud. If you don't mind, I've a date with a nice bottle of malt and some good friends of mine."
He turned as if to head below, but stopped in his tracks at Scott's bellow.
"Don't move, or I'll shoot!"
Constable McKinven sidled over to Scott, who was now wielding his pistol.
"Sergeant, I don't think that's enforced standing orders."
"I dare say it's no. But if you can tell me the right piece of legislation we need to quote to take this tub out to Blan, then be my guest,"
replied Scott from the corner of his mouth.
No, we never covered that at the police college."
"Right. Well, at gunpoint it'll have to be, then. Desperate times call for desperate measures. Superintendent Donald used to say that all the time.
Look what happened to him."
Another head appeared around the wheelhouse door.
"No doogie, doogie, doogie," said Hamish, looking none too steady on his feet. "I've been fortunate to have my ain vessel commandeered by the constabulary, and let me tell you, I made mair money oot of it than a whole week at the fishing. Aye, a week of proud shoals, tae. If you ask me, you're looking a gift horse in the mouth if you turn this man doon." "Oh, you reckon?"
said the fisherman.
"I do that. In any case, I know that bugger with a gun well enough. He means what he says. He'll likely shoot you in a couple of minutes if you don't bend to his will.
He leaned towards the other man. "Between you and me, he's fair nasty wi' a drink, and it looks as though he's carrying a cartful right now. Just smile and take him where he wants to go. I've few enough friends left to contemplate losing another."
He winked up at Scott. The deal was done. The two other passengers clambered unsteadily up the ladder to make their way for the police officers, who made their way, equally unsteadily, onto the small fishing boat.
"Get me to Blan, and don't spare the horses," said Scott, anxious to get under way.
"Sergeant," said McKinven, tapping him on the shoulder, "these old blokes are both drunk."
"And?
Do you think they should be taking the boat out? We can't condone this."
"Oh, shut up, or I'll shoot you in awe."
As the little vessel chugged out onto the loch, Scott's phone rang.
"Yes, ma'am, I'm on my way."
He listened for a moment.
"Well, Mr. Newell and the lifeboat were unavailable. We might be a wee bit longer than we thought."
Scott grimaced as the skipper staggered at the wheel. Chapter 34. The AGM was about to reconvene. When Bruce took his seat, he was surprised to be greeted by a pleasant smile from his mother, though his daughter, Nadia, looked sullen and resentful. As others began to gather around the huge table, Ailsa spoke.
"Part of a boardroom coup, darling. I knew there was something afoot this year, but I didn't think you were going to be part of it. Well done. You're normally as transparent as that window. I didn't think the little plan you mentioned the other day would involve siding with your cousin against me. Perhaps you are a Shannon after all."
Bruce was about to reply when a tall security guard walked up to his mother and handed her the parcel he had found on the front steps. Bruce noticed that the box hadn't been opened, so guessed that they had scanned it in some way to check for anything untoward. Rather than look at the contents of the package, his mother took it off the table and left it at her feet.
"I wonder what it is," said Nadia.
"Oh, most probably some jam or a knitted jumper from one of the villagers. I always get a few things from the ladies of my own vintage. Fewer of us every year, of course," said Ailsa, suddenly looking rueful.
Bruce was puzzled by how well his mother appeared to be taking Maxwell's victory. He was now solely in charge of everything, the outright boss of a massive organization. It was something Ailsa had been trying to avoid for a long time. Bruce supposed that she had given up, tired of the constant battle against her nephew. She couldn't know that Maxwell's delight at his success was going to be temporary, very temporary.
"Hi," he said, as the dark-haired girl walked past him to attend to his cousin.
"Remember me?"
She stopped and looked at him for a few moments.
"From where exactly?"
she said with a smile.
"The Churchill, you know, in Notting Hill Gate, the night before Hogmanay, eh? Goodness, I must be getting old. Only had eyes for Trenton, I suppose."
"I'm sorry," she said, walking away. "You must have me confused with someone else."
Bruce thought for a moment. If there was one thing he could do, it was remember a pretty face. Even more, it was remember a cute backside. Her blatant lie made him uneasy. He took the phone from his pocket and dialed Casely's number. Again, it went straight to voicemail. He looked back at his mother. As the room came to order, she sat, smiling and seemingly unperturbed. Bruce Shannon was confused. There was no thought in Daly's head but the cold and pain in his knees and back. Being trussed up like this for hours was unbearable torture. He couldn't think straight, couldn't work out whether this was caused by the blow to his head or if he'd been drugged. He recalled setting out from Cursabay House, traipsing through the snow towards the glen. But then, nothing made sense. He knew that there was something he couldn't get a hold of, a detail that remained out of reach. Intermittent moans from behind him told him that he wasn't alone in this cold, harsh space. His colleagues were still with him. Suddenly, someone cried out, a cry of great pain, and Daly was gripped by rough, strong hands. His bonds were untied, and he was dragged to his feet. The pain that shot up his legs and back almost made him pass out.
"Where are you taking me?" he asked.
His throat was so dry that his words were barely audible. Thoughts of Colin Grant filled his head, as a mugful of some stinking brown liquid was thrust in his face, and his head was jerked back by the hair. Someone held his nose, his jaw was forced open, and the musty, bitter drink was poured into his mouth. Though he coughed and spluttered, he couldn't resist the swallow reflex, gulping in air in between mouthfuls of the foul drink. Suddenly he felt weak, his body losing sensation from the legs up. He slumped into a pair of strong arms, and was dragged out of the cave and onto the rocky shore beyond. Daly was aware of the screech of gulls, the crunch of pebbles, and then the rough springy grass of the Macher under his feet. Before him was an old van coughing clouds of acrid fumes into the cold air. As his captors forced him into the back of the van, he tried to push back to fight against them, but he was too weak, and they pushed him inside easily. Before long the van pulled away and struggled up the path from the shore onto a narrow road, turning quickly onto a forestry track, where a thick canopy of branches sheltered the road from the worst of the snow. Up ahead, a copse of tall oak trees, their bare branches clothed in winter threads, were still beneath a pearlescent sky. A long, dark stone stood out against the white. Scott shivered in the wheelhouse of the old fishing boat. He'd been forced to travel aboard a number of different craft since his first trip to Kinloch, but this seemed the slowest of them all.
"Can you no gie a bit of welly?"
said Scott to the skipper, whom everyone seemed to know as Binder.
"How much fucking welly do you think we've got? We'll get a good 12 knots out of her for a fair wind. No as much the day, what with with the current weather conditions," he replied, with a distinct slur.
"You'll no beat Newell's rib in a standing start, that's for sure, my man."
"Och, ribs. Aye, they'll go fast, nae bother. You just try riding out a heavy sea on one of them, then you'll know about it. You can sail to America in this vessel with a sound mind."
"If you'd 20 years to spare."
Their conversation was interrupted by Constable McKinven poking his head through a hatch at the rear of the wheelhouse.
"Sergeant Scott, a bit of an issue below."
"What kind of issue?"
"There seems to be rather a lot of water coming in through the side of the boat. That kind of issue."
Binder turned and faced the young policeman with a scowl.
"There's no a vessel afloat that doesn't take some water now and again. Mind, this is a craft made for the finest timber, the way boats are supposed to be made. When it's cold like this, the wood contracts, and you always get a wee bit of seepage. If you'd a brain in your head, you'd be getting a couple of buckets and bailing out for time to time. The old boy down there is telling us we'll all end up in a cold, watery grave. Och, would you listen to it? The younger generation fair scunner me. Constable Dowd took his whisky off him. He was worried the old boy was getting the worse for wear. Well, now there's your answer. Gie the man back his whisky and you'll restore his his peace of mind."
"Do as he says, son," said Scott. "Hamish hasn't died a winter yet. And get a bucket and start getting rid of some of that water." He eyed Binder. "How long until we get to Blan?"
The old man squinted into the distance, then stood on tiptoes, looking at the lie of the land through the grubby wheelhouse window.
"Do you know, I'm no right sure. Nothing looks right with all this snow lying about, and that's a fact."